This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Sue Conzelman is Reader in Management at Birkbeck, London, and Director of the London Centre for Corporate Governance and Ethics. She holds a PhD from the University of Notre Dame and is a Research Associate of the Centre for Business Research here in Cambridge. Her research examines the effects of institutions and organisation on economic and social performance, notably in employment relations, and more recently in the resilience of financial systems. Mark Favard-Davis is a Research Associate of the London Centre for Corporate Governance and Ethics, with a professional background in research-based marketing. His current work examines the economic, political, and cultural influences on the development of both economic structures and their governance frameworks. So, having introduced you, over to you, Sue.
Thanks. As Mark said, what I'll be talking about today is our book that came out in September called Banking Systems in the Crisis, The Faces of Liberal Capitalism. Now, this book is a direct result of a chance purchase of the Financial Times on a gray, fairly typical March afternoon in Cambridge Railway Station. And in this edition of the Financial Times was a piece here that I'll pass around, which looked at the 50 top global banks in 2009 and compared that with the 50 top global banks 10 years earlier. Now, what was interesting about this piece is the groups of banks from different countries that disappeared from the list in 2009 and the groups that appeared. And notably, the American and British banks were notable for their absence, while the Chinese banks and other sort of developing country banks were notable by their presence. So Mark and Gerhardt, who were determined to not write the paper they were supposed to be writing on bank bailouts for our meeting at SASE, decided that they would explore this puzzle. And so they wrote a paper that looked at four groups that had appeared, four groups that had disappeared. And after that, we decided to collaborate on a paper looking at the four main LMEs, because the American and British banks were notable because they had disappeared in 2008, where the Canadian and Australian banks were notable for their appearance. And the result of that is the paper that Mark drew your attention to, which came out in the CJE in 2012. Now, what was interesting to us about this puzzle was the fact that it seemed to contradict the OECD's interpretation of the crisis as being a result of corporate governance failings within the individual institutions involved. And if that were the case, we would have expected to see a much more random distribution of banks in 2008 compared with 10 years earlier. We wouldn't have expected to see national blocks, which suggests that there may have been something going on in terms of the national regulatory systems that might have contributed to their experiences. So that's what we were interested in exploring. And if you look at the table on this slide, you'll see that in the FT article, which is the first column looking at the change in market capitalization, the US and the UK lost heavily between 1999 and 2009. By contrast, the Canadian and Australian banks actually gained in terms of market capitalization during that period of time. When you look at the magnitude of the bank bailouts, you can see that we have data for all six countries, because we decided for the book to add New Zealand and Ireland to the list. And they fall nicely into the grouping, with Ireland joining the US and the UK and New Zealand joining the other two. And you can see here that as of March 2009, the US had spent 6.8% of GDP rescuing failing banks. That compares to 19.8% for the UK and a staggering 43% for Ireland. And this is a sharp contrast to the other three, where Australia used 0.1% to help struggling banks, and Canada and New Zealand almost nothing. Now, this is a real puzzle when you also confront it with the comparative corporate governance literature and the comparative institutional literature, all of which lump these six countries into the liberal market economy variety of capitalism. And so they would have predicted similar trajectories for these six countries, which makes the fact that they have split into two groups something of a puzzle. And none of the literature on varieties of capitalism or comparative corporate governance finds any sort of way of differentiating these six countries. So this really is sort of a puzzle from that from an academic perspective as well. Now, I think it's important to define what we mean by some of the terms we're looking at, because what we were interested in exploring in this book is the way that different institutional capabilities interacted with responses to major events, such as the collapse of Bretton Woods during the 1970s and the stagflationary crises of that period, which then marked a revival of pre-Keynesian liberal economic ideas. And what we were interested in is seeing how that might have been operating along with these twin processes of economic liberalization and financialization since the paradigm shift of the 70s to reach the situation that we were in 2007-08 when the American subprime real estate bubble burst, and then that spread to the rest of the world to create a situation that is of sort of unprecedented proportion, even comparing it to the Depression. So in terms of the terms we're using, when we look at neoliberalization, because these terms can be quite value-laden, so I think it's important to say what we understand them to mean. Neoliberalization we understand to be simply the return to economic liberalism that followed the paradigm shift of the 1960s and 70s. So we're trying to not link it so much to some of the controversial aspects of neoliberalism that sometimes come up when people are being critical of economic liberalism. Although we are critical, we're trying to stay away from that area of debate. In terms of economic liberalization, we understand that to be a process of macro-institutional change where the central pillars of a country's political economy shift toward greater reliance on market mechanisms. And financialization, and this is following Krippner's understanding of it, we understand that to be also a process of macro-institutional change where finance serves to become a driver of economic growth and assumes an increasingly important role in the political economy. And what we see happening from the late 1960s and 1970s onward is these two processes of macro-institutional change operating together and serving to reinforce each other, especially in the six liberal market economies. And so that's why it's interesting that seeing those economies, which all liberalized again during the 1970s, why is it that we see them splitting off in terms of the vulnerability or lack of vulnerability or resilience of their financial sectors, which became apparent when the 2007-08 crisis broke and has become even more apparent in the 5 years since that time. Now, what we did after deciding to pursue this research is we decided to set up an international research network with multidisciplinary teams of academics in the six LMEs, and we were concerned that we would have within these teams and within our network the kind of academic expertise that would be required to look at these institutional changes associated with these processes, but also that would have an intimate knowledge of the particular country that they would be contributing information about to the group. And you'll notice when you look at the different teams that we've got expertise in the area of corporate governance, regulation, banking and finance, law, business, and markets. And so that helps us to fill the areas because we were interested in particular, developments within legal systems, especially with respect to financial market regulation, differences in corporate governance, because that affected the kinds of behaviors of companies and industries. And also we were interested in economic policy and the way that markets were constructed and designed to operate. And so within our international network, we had those capabilities. We had a first meeting in June of 2011 at Birkbeck to formally launch the research. At that point, we invited the commissioning editor for Routledge to our meeting, and she spoke with us, and we had a chance to talk with her about what we were planning to do. We had already submitted our proposal. We had a contract in August. We had another meeting in September where we contributed first drafts of the country case study chapters and received feedback from external reviewers. And we submitted our manuscript in February 2012. So things happened very fast once we had the contract. But because we had the expertise within the group and people already working on these areas, it came together really well. At the end of my talk, I'll talk a little bit about the next stage of the research, which is already underway. And if you're interested, you can let me know, and I'll sort of filter information about that to you, and you can follow it as we're developing it. Now, in terms of the book's layout, it's divided into three main parts. In the first part, we've got two chapters. The first one, which we call the Not-So-Global Crisis, explains and introduces the empirical puzzle that we want to explore. It then gives our sort of development of the institutional literature that is useful in trying to understand the institutional changes that gave rise to some of the outcomes that we observed. It lays out our hypotheses, and it presents our framework for analysis. The second chapter locates the six case studies and the questions we're interested in addressing on them in a much longer historical context. The middle of the book presents the six case studies. And what it does is it explores within those case studies how the institutional configurations in those countries and their financial systems influence the outcomes associated with the twin processes of economic liberalization and financialization. And then the third part of the book provides our analysis and conclusions. So it draws out the themes that emerge from the case studies. It confronts those with our hypotheses and draws the conclusions that we would follow from those, which I'll talk about a little bit at the end. Another thing that it does is it presents an alternative to neoliberalism, which is called ordoliberalism, that was lost for many years with the ascent of what we now know as the neoliberal variety of economic liberalism. The reason that we wanted to deal with this in the concluding section is because this variety of economic liberalism has been sort of revived by those on both the political right and the political left as a possible alternative way of going forward from the crisis. But what we conclude is that actually structurally, ordo and neoliberalism are not significantly different. And so we don't think that ordoliberalism really takes us all that far in identifying a resolution to the continuing crisis. Then we draw our conclusions, and that lays then the foundation for the next, hopefully, stage of the research, which will produce something comparable to this book. Now, in the time that I have today, what I want to do is just to tell the story that emerges from our research, because it's, you know, when you've got a book, it's hard to sort of summarize it. And what I will do is go back and forth a bit between the kinds of institutional changes that we see in these six countries, how that might have affected firm behavior, which then fed back into changes in institutions. And then I'll talk about some of the feedback effects so that you've got a clear idea of what some of these changes are and how they might have shaped the kinds of developments that left the US, the UK, and Ireland in a much more vulnerable place than the other three countries when the financial crisis hit. And then, as I said, at the end, after drawing conclusions, I'll lay out what our next stage of the research is likely to be, or the direction we're going. Now, in terms of economic liberalization, most people associate the return to economic liberalism with the conservative Reagan and Thatcher governments of the 1980s. But in reality, it can be traced much earlier. And it's interesting that Canada was the first of these six countries to experiment with economic liberalism. In 1964, it set up the Porter Commission in response to the destabilizing effects of capital inflows into the Canadian credit markets. Now, one of the responses was tight control on international credit flows into the Canadian financial market. But what's interesting about the Porter Commission is that it was it believed in markets at a time when Keynesianism was in its heyday. It also believed in the role of monetary policy from a Keynesian perspective. So it believed that monetary policy was important, but as a complement to fiscal policy. And so it saw the objective of macroeconomic policy to be the effective coordination of both fiscal policy aimed at unemployment and growth, and monetary policy aimed at containing inflation. And that was quite unique at that particular time. But I think it's important that when Canada was moving towards economic liberalization, it was doing it during a period when Keynesian economic theory and policy was dominant. So it wasn't doing it when the monetarists began to move things in a different direction during the 1970s. Now, the more general return to economic liberalism was a catalyst for that was the stagflationary crisis period of the 1970s. During this period, in 1971, the Nixon administration in the United States announced that gold backing for the American dollar would no longer be provided. And what that effectively did was lifted the restrictions on international capital flows that had been in place since 1944 with the establishment of the Bretton Woods International Monetary System. So that ultimately led to the collapse of Bretton Woods and the inability of national governments to control their money supplies. In 1971 as well, the UK Heath government, which was struggling with a sterling crisis at the time, announced a policy of competition and credit control to try to stimulate competition within the financial sector in the UK. But at the same time, it made a dash for growth to try to combat unemployment. Regardless of these, by the end of the 1970s, these responses had failed to solve the challenges of that decade. And so by the turn of the next decade, by the 1980s, both countries saw a radical change in government, with the Reagan government rising to power in the United States and the Thatcher government rising to power in the UK. Now, Reaganism and Thatcherism, which are sort of the terms given for the kind of economic policies pursued by those governments, represented a conscious abandonment of Keynesian theory and policy, and a move away from an emphasis on the state having a role in maintaining full employment and growth towards a concern about withdrawal of the state from macroeconomic management and towards a support for unfettered markets and concern about inflation as opposed to unemployment. Now, because of the apparent economic prosperity of the 1980s, that boosted confidence in neoclassical economics and in the economic policies that were supported by these two governments, which served as a catalyst for helping economic liberalism to become more widely spread from that era onward. Now, in the case of Ireland, it was somewhat different. Ireland in the 1980s experienced a very, very serious recession. And in response, what it decided to do was to take advantage of its low-cost commercial property market and its very favorable corporate income taxes. And so it decided that it would market itself as a very sort of profitable center for corporate headquarters. Now, that served to sort of awaken the Celtic Tiger. And in 2002, with entry into the European Monetary Union, the sharp reduction in interest rates fueled a property bubble in Ireland. Now, as a result of that, and with the objective of trying to make its financial sector an international center for financial activities, Ireland decided that it would also extend its favorable corporate tax rates to financial institutions. And so a lot of financial institutions located in Ireland in order to take advantage of that. And what that effectively did was supercharge the property bubble, which ultimately collapsed and left Ireland even more devastated than the US and the UK in the wake of the crisis. By contrast, in the case of Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, you had a shaking of confidence in the state's ability to manage the economy, but that didn't undermine confidence in the social welfare state. So what you had was where social welfare provisions were being privatized, there was concern that they be regulated in the public interest. So where the state stepped away from provision, it stepped into the role of regulating in the public interest. So you ended up with a much more moderate form of economic liberalism where the state didn't completely withdraw, and there was recognition of the importance of re-regulation where privatization had taken place. So a different nature to the kind of economic liberalism that these two groups of countries were adopting. Now, in terms of the institutional effects, I'm going to talk first about the institutional effects that seem to us to be important, and then I'll look at the changes in firm behavior. But it's important to realize that these two sets of effects were happening together in an iterative process and reinforcing and feeding off each other. But I think for clarity, in order to make it possible to sort of get your head around what was happening, it makes sense to separate them first and then to look at the feedback effects that we might identify. The changing role of the central bank and the central government is very interesting, I think, for this period of time. Traditionally, the central bank of a country is responsible for regulation and supervision of the financial services industry. The Treasury is responsible for monetary policy, and the central government is responsible for macroeconomic policy, which during the pre-neoliberal period was maintaining full employment and a healthy rate of growth. During the 1970s, with the stagflationary crisis, we saw a shift in the focus of policy away from full employment and economic growth towards control over inflation. Now, control over inflation is a politically unpopular policy because what it inevitably involves is contractionary policy designed to rein in prices. So there was a political interest in separating the government, central government's activities from control over inflation. Whether it's stated or not stated, you get that feeling when you read through some of the policy changes that were happening and some of the political debates that were going on in these six countries, that this was part of the objective of granting the central bank operational independence and then assigning it responsibility for control over inflation. So what happens during the 90s, at different points, but in all of these six countries, is the central bank was granted operational independence, and it was assigned responsibility for monetary policy. In the UK, Ireland, and the US, central bank power was extended beyond deposit-taking institutions, which are traditional financial institutions, to cover some of these shadow banking institutions, and eventually the big conglomerate banks, which would have both investment and commercial banking operations. In Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, as I said earlier, it was much more incremental and pragmatic in terms of the responses they took during the period of liberalization. And what happened there was rather than having the central bank be responsible for all of the different types of financial institutions that might be there, they set up separate regulatory agencies early on as some of these non-bank financial institutions began to emerge. So as you have non-bank institutions that are sort of taking things off the balance sheet of the financial institutions, separate regulatory bodies were set up to regulate and supervise them. So a different orientation to the role of the central bank in these two groups. Across the board, the central government then, since it was no longer responsible for full employment, it wasn't responsible for monetary policy because that was assigned to the central bank, it was given responsibility for maintaining market freedom. And interesting there as well, in the US, the UK, and Ireland, market freedom basically meant free markets, where in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, it meant allowing markets to permit competition. So while competition and free markets, you know, competitive markets and free markets are often used interchangeably, the reality is that there's a subtle difference in the way that the markets were conceptualized in these two groups, which I think had significant outcomes later on. Another set of institutional changes that's interesting is the approach that these countries took to further deregulation, particularly of stock markets. In the US, the UK, and Ireland, the deregulation was sudden. 1975 May Day in New York, all regulation was lifted. In London, the same thing happened with Big Bang in 1986. And the Irish Stock Exchange experienced Big Bang because the Irish Stock Exchange became part of the London Stock Exchange in 1973 and then gained independence again in 1995. So sudden deregulation of stock markets in these three countries. By contrast, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, deregulation took place, but it was very incremental and prudential, in line with the other deregulation that was going on in their financial markets. The structure of financial market regulation is another important institutional development. And this occurred over the three decades of liberalization. And as I described, you know, in the three of the countries, it was very incremental, the way that new agencies came in as new types of financial institutions emerged. And at the end, when the crisis hit, we had a spectrum of regulatory systems in terms of structure. In Ireland, the UK, and New Zealand, we had a unified regulator, so a single regulator that was responsible for regulating all of the institutions within the financial services industry. In Canada and Australia, at different points, and Australia followed the Canadian model eventually, you ended up with what's called a Twin Peaks structure, where you have a separate regulator for market stability and conduct of business. So one is to make sure that the institutions are behaving in a way that keeps the market stable. The other is to protect consumer interests in the products that are being marketed. The US has a very fragmented system. So we have institutions at the level of the state, institutions at the level of the country, and then a whole range of institutions within different, you know, within the financial market area, within the stock market area and within the financial market area. So very, very fragmented system. Now, in the wake of the crisis, both the unified and the fragmented system have been heavily criticized for failing to prevent the excesses that are seen to have given rise to the crisis, and also for failing to recognize the danger signals as they were approaching. And interestingly, in the UK, we've already got the beginnings of a Twin Peaks system being erected. Our next door neighbor happens to work at the FSA and is responsible for part of this, so we have a little bit of inside information there. And I don't know if you noticed that the FSA or that the new chairman of the Bank of England used to be with the Central Bank in Canada. Now, I think that that's sort of a mistaken. He's got the same institutions, the same system, and I think, you know, bringing a person into this system is probably not going to have the effect that it's trying to signal. And the other thing is, when you read all of the sort of fanfare about him coming and people said, oh, he saved the Canadian system, you know, he pulled them back from the brink. But the reality is Canada didn't actually experience a financial crisis like we did. So I think there's a lot of fanfare there that may not lead to what is hoped it will lead to. But that's just personal opinion. So in terms of changes in firm behavior across all of these six countries, we saw financial conglomeration, meaning one-stop shop financial institutions emerging via mergers and acquisitions. However, again, very different nature of the kinds of firms that emerged and the kinds of activities they engaged in. In the US, the UK, and Ireland, these three countries' financial institutions are, for the most part, profit-oriented, shareholder-owned institutions. So these three countries are under pressure, or their financial institutions are under pressure to deliver short-term profits and short-term share price appreciation. So that puts incredible pressure on them, especially in an environment like the one we had from the early 2000s to the crisis, an environment where traditional financial instruments were not delivering very high yields. So a lot of incentives for innovation and finding ways of making money in an environment where that wasn't so easy. Now, these are also countries which had as an objective becoming international centers for financial activities. So you have internationalization going on at the same time that these very large financial conglomerates, who are primarily international in orientation, are populating the financial system. So the end result is a bifurcation where you've got very large international financial institutions with both investment and commercial and retail banking activities, and a whole host of local, small deposit-taking institutions that are often not-for-profit. So separation within the industry. Another interesting development is that the investment banks come to dominate within the conglomerates that have both investment and commercial and retail banking activities, which makes them of a particular nature in terms of the kinds of speculative activities they're going to be tolerant of, the kinds of risks they're going to be tolerant of traders taking, etc. So the result is that there are severe regulatory challenges in these three countries. You have the aggravation of the too-big-to-fail problem. So you've got too-big-to-fail institutions that are, as we see, so big that they ended up having to be rescued. You have the threat of regulatory arbitrage. So if they don't like the regulations that are being imposed on them, they can leave. And we've seen threats of that as talk of regulation has happened since the crisis. You have a shift in power away from the state and regulators towards the private sector, in particular the financial institutions. And regulators found and find themselves with considerable conflicts of interest. They're responsible for maintaining stability within the financial services industry, but they're also responsible for making it an attractive location for very highly mobile international financial institutions. So I think those things together have contributed to some of the problems that these three countries have experienced in terms of not only the way they were prepared when the crisis hit, but also the lack of any really significant change since 2007 and 8. Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, and the bottom looks like it's been cut off. First of all, large domestic banks dominate. I'll tell you what should be at the bottom there. So these three countries in Canada, they were very keen to keep foreign financial institutions out of the Canadian financial system, especially out of their credit market from the 1964 Porter Commission onward. And so they have five very large Canadian banks that dominate the financial services industry, who have branches within all of the provinces. So you don't have the possibility of provincial interests causing a bank to do certain things that might be in the interest of one province but not the other, which tends to balance their relative power within the financial system. Australia opened their financial system to international financial institutions in 1985, and about 15 entered. But within not such a long time, they either failed or withdrew. So by the time the crisis hit, the Australian financial system was populated by what are called the four pillars, the four large Australian banks, who were at that point stronger than ever. The New Zealand financial system is populated by Australian banks. So, basically domestic financial industries with very large firms, but they are domestic and so much easier to supervise and regulate. Another interesting thing that happened is when the investment and commercial and retail banks conglomerates were established in these three countries, the investment banks came under the control of the commercial and retail banks. And this is partly because of the cultural attitude towards banks and bankers in these three countries. There are some famous quotes that we used in the paper you may have come across. In Canada, there's a popular saying that,
Bank bashing is a popular sport.
Yeah, bank bash. So they like to bank bash. They don't trust banks, and they like them to be under supervision. Australia, one of their main sort of commentators made the... I'll let you sit, because it's got some...
I won't try the accent, but it's a chap called Maiden who pointed out that banks are bastards, and bigger banks are bigger bastards.
So, culturally, there's a real, interest in supervising these politically, or not politically, but unpopular segments of the economy. And so as a result, regulation in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand is much more straightforward. So they don't have the problem of regulatory arbitrage. They don't care about being financial centers for international financial activities. They're concerned that their banks are doing what banks should do and providing the utility function of channeling liquidity to productive sides of the economy. Now, in terms of firm behavior, also significant is during the 2000s, we saw an important change in the banking business model. So we had movement away from the originate and hold model, where banks would originate a financial product and hold it to maturity, to an originate and distribute model. So this is where securitization becomes important. So banks are originating financial products. Securities tend to be populated by all kinds of things. And the idea is that you would originate these products and then sell them on. Now again, in the way that these models were implemented, we see a difference across the two sets of countries. In the US, the UK, and Ireland, because companies are under serious pressure from shareholders, there's a drive for profits and short-term share price appreciation, which has really encouraged the expansion of the shadow banking sector to help operate this system. And we've seen a lot of innovation going on where securitization, by populating these derivative products with risky products to increase the yield on those products, has encouraged the origination of very risky but very high yield products, and then the objective of selling them on before some of the weaker assets begin to default and the products lose their value. This is especially the case in the US and Ireland. And in the US, it fueled the subprime real estate market, which most of us know quite a bit about now. And in Ireland, it fueled the property bubble that ultimately burst and caused the damage it did. By contrast, again, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, they have shareholders in their financial institutions, but they don't tend to be widely dispersed. They tend to be block holders who hold on to their shares for a long period of time. So you don't see the pressures to deliver short-term share price appreciation operating to the degree in these countries that you did in the other three. You also have really conservative banking practices, the norm. So not a lot of enthusiasm for shadow banking or securitization or financial innovation, but real concern about financial institutions doing what they should be doing, and that is providing a good return, but a steady, safe return. So again, very different behavior that, of course, would generate differences in terms of the kinds of outcomes. Now, sort of bringing those together, we identify two sets of feedback effects that we think are important. The first are called regulatory dialectic effects, and those are the kinds of effects where you see firm behavior in response to regulation causing the need for further regulation. So it's sort of firms doing things that then need to be met with changes in regulation. And I think a couple of examples that are in the paper are useful in demonstrating the difference in how this occurred across the Anglosphere. In the 1980s, in Australia, their corporate cowboys activities resulted in widespread corporate failure, corporate scandals, and a huge financial crisis. The Australians responded with corporate governance reform and prudential regulation. In America, during the same period of time, we saw the savings and loan crisis, which resulted in almost no changes in regulation. In Canada and the UK, we didn't see a general crisis, but what we did see was the failure of very large banks and insurance trusts. And again, very different responses. In Canada, because of concern about systemic risk, the result was very serious prudential regulation reform. In the UK, the failures were seen to be the result of problems in the individual institutions, and so there really wasn't any significant response to the failure of these companies because it wasn't considered a systemic issue. So what we would conclude is that all of these countries had looked into the abyss. Two of them decided they didn't want to come back, and the Americans and the British decided this was kind of an exciting place to be for risk sports. The second set of effects are macro feedback effects, and these are linked to the effect of financialization on income inequality. And these are much more consistent across the six countries. What this graph illustrates is the change in the percent of total income earned by the top 1% in the income distribution. And you can see that from the 1970s onward, in all of these countries, it's increased dramatically. Now, I see that I've only got a few minutes left, so I'll whiz through these. Some examples of how macro feedback effects work are, one might be the effect of financialization on industry restructuring such that you end up with a deindustrialization of the productive side of the economy and an increasing in the dominance of the financial side. And a good example would be the corporate rating period in the UK during the 1960s and 70s and the leveraged buyout period in the US during the 80s. And what happened was investors were able to acquire controlling stakes in manufacturing companies whose shares were undervalued on the stock market and to restructure them, justified by the efficient markets hypothesis and the theory that they were that the stock market was an effective discipline for underperforming managers. But the effect was a destruction of labor's opportunities for income and employment, and so we see a skewing of the income distribution resulting from that. Also, in terms of the political process, because financialization benefits the wealthy and financial actors who hold investments in financial products, it tends to result in a prioritization of the interests of the wealthy and financial side of the economy. And at the same time, a marginalization of left-wing movements and parties and trade unions. And again, that has the same effect of intensifying movement towards inequality. We also see the financialization of households, workers, and the poor who have to take on credit and buy cheap imports in order to maintain living standards in the face of stagnating incomes and poor job prospects. So you end up with a cumulative causation process where financialization is driving inequality, which continues to make things worse as it works itself out. In terms of conclusions, our first set of conclusions really revolves around the way that financialized neoliberalism might be assessed. So first, we find that markets are clearly political and social constructs, and that even laissez-faire is a policy decision. So that gives rise to the question of whose interests are markets constructed to operate in the favor of. We also find an inherent tendency in financialized neoliberalism toward macroeconomic imbalance and inequality, which means we're always heading that direction. But how far are we from actually realizing it is important. And then also, and I think this is a really important conclusion that comes out in Steve Keen's chapter on Australia, is that in all of these countries, the direction of change is the same, but the pace and intensity varies. And what he suggests is it may well be that when the 2007 and 8 crisis hit, it's just that the US, the UK, and Ireland were further along in this process, and that actually dodging that bullet may not mean that the next crisis won't hit these other countries much more seriously than they did. And in fact, in Australia, already they're talking about deregulating because they think that they're doing so well. So, you know, that's a real concern that we'll have to bear in mind. And finally, this leads us into the next stage of the research. We realize that LMEs, although they have so much in common institutionally, culturally, historically, they can develop different institutional responses to a common external shock. And what we found in looking at these cross-country differences is that actually there were within-country differences too. So within each of these countries, there were alternative approaches to development that were or weren't taken at particular points in time. So what we want to look at in this next stage of the research is what are the alternatives within liberal market or liberal capitalism for the way to organize and operate the financial system, for the way to design economic policy and industrial policy, and for looking at how corporate law might affect the kind of corporate structures that we see, especially in the context of the financial sector. Because we feel that if these alternatives are already present, although they may be secondary paths of development or even latent within the liberal capitalism system, if they're there, they're likely to be much more politically and institutionally feasible than alternatives that are transported from outside and put onto these systems. So that's where we're taking the research, and maybe in a year or two I'll be back to tell you what we've found. So thank you.
Well, first of all, can I thank you for a really interesting paper. I mean, the paper I have read, I've learned a lot from the presentation as well as reading the paper, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. And I think, you know, the value of this work is has meant many positive things about it, but the greatest value for me is that it shows how the variety and complexity of the financial system, and indeed, you know, what we call the market system, across the different cultures, you know, because this group of six countries, you know, they do have so much in common, and yet differences in culture can outweigh differences in even in formal legal systems. And I have to make a confession here, because I've had three careers, and at the end of my first career, I was one of those foreign bankers who went into Australia in the late 1980s.
Oh, right. Were you a cowboy?
No, I wasn't. I was not a corporate cowboy. But I went in, it was very, you'll indulge me, I hope, but I had been working for what was originally considered a rather conservative British institution that was involved in the long-term finance of smaller companies called the Industrial and Commercial Finance Corporation. And the idea was that this model could be exported, and, you know, we could make money out of exporting it. So I went to work for one of the big Australian banks called Westpac in Melbourne, and was asked to... Well, there was already an ICFC clone had been established in Australia, but it was running into certain difficulties, so I was sent there to do something about it. And I very rapidly discovered what the problem was, which was that the British model had been that you take the, you make these long-term loans, you take a certain amount of risk, and in return for this, you get a small equity stake. It's a nominal sort of cost. You hold it for about 25 years, and then you sell it on the stock market, and everybody's happy. And the problem was is that the Australian banks were already doing it without the equity. In other words, they were taking venture capital risks without realising it. And this was 1987/8. And the problem really was the intensity of competition that the foreign banks had come into the Australian market. The incumbent banks didn't know how to cope, really, so they just wrote anything. And it made it my life difficult, you know, since there were very few deals left that I was able to negotiate. And I retired from the field after about 2 years and went elsewhere. But it, and of course, it all ended in dreadful tears. About, I can't remember the exact dates, but it had been 1990, 1991. Mm-hmm. Well, I was far away by then. But the interesting thing is that they did learn from the mistake. Let's hope they don't unlearn it this time around. So I find that very interesting, and the differences are fascinating between the different countries. The second thing, which is actually didn't draw it to our attention tonight, but I found a really interesting point on your work comparing the American and the UK experience, was this business of the limited liability of mortgagors. I mean, i.e. mortgagors are the people who actually take out the mortgage to buy the house.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, I really hadn't, that hadn't kind of dawned on me how important that was to the whole subprime thing, the idea that you could basically, you know, hand back the keys. Okay. People talk about doing that in the UK, but it's different here, that actually you hand back the keys, you still owe the money. But in the States, of course, that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's a huge difference between the two financial systems. And I suppose, with the exception of Northern Rock, again in the paper, you mentioned how mortgage-backed securities weren't so prevalent.
Right.
Well, at least the way they were written in the States didn't happen in the way they did here.
Right.
My third observation, and then I've got some questions, is about. Well, actually, straight into a question, really. I mean, when you look at the experience of the UK building societies, where you had a very stable financial sector financing residential mortgages for 40-50 years, which was then privatised or demutualised. One of the biggest problems with it, it seems to me, was that with neoliberalism, as you've defined it, we moved from a, with that went a move from structural to prudential regulation. I mean, I think you call it institutional regulation. I can't remember the word you use. But anyway, the idea that basically you have building societies that do mortgages and banks that do commercial business and merchant banks, we used to call them, that did investment banking. And everything was in nice little firewalled boxes. So my question is there any way we can go back to that, or is that now, are we stuck with prudential regulation? Second question is, again, there was a hint in your paper that part of the reason that the Canadian, Australian and Canadian Australian systems were more resilient was that there was a democratic drag on the liberalisation process. Which makes a lot of sense to me. But why didn't that work in the US, because that's a federal system as well? But yeah, is it anything to do with democracy in the widest sense, or is that just a red herring? And the third question, which is, I can't resist really, because it is the Keynes seminar, which is whether, again, your paper sets the wider context for this in terms of the Bretton Woods system, or demise of, and the move to financial liberalisation generally. Is this not really all a long-term consequence of the free movement of capital, and to the extent that there is an answer, it means going back to a system where capital movements are controlled, however politically impossible that currently seems. Because I couldn't resist these quotes from Keynes. He says, "Ideas, knowledge, art, hospitality, travel, these are the things which should of their nature be international, but let goods be homespun whenever it is reasonably and conveniently possible, and above all, let finance be primarily national. The whereabouts of the better old will shift with the speed of the magic carpet. Loose funds may sweep around the world, disorganizing all steady business. Nothing is more certain than that the movement of capital funds must be regulated."